Hey everybody, welcome to episode 153 of For the Love of Guns. Today, we're going to talk about ARs. Now, I've always said that you assemble an AR, you don't build an AR. But today's guest may have just changed my mind about that. I have Nathan Mitchell from Mitchell Defense on. Now, I met him at SHOT, and he's got a unique take on ARs. We look at an AR as a system, not a collection of parts. You'll understand what I mean about that in just a little bit. Now, before we talk to Nathan, it's time to talk about two amazing organizations to help me bring you content. The first one is Ammo Squared. You've been hearing me talk about Ammo Squared for a while. It's an amazing organization with a great concept for buying ammo. Now, we buy ammo online. It's nothing new, but the way they're doing it is completely different. What they're doing is they're buying ammo and storing it in their facility for you. You tell them how much you want taken out, when you want it shipped to you, and they'll just send it to you. That way you can store it at their facility. It's climate controlled, it's insured. You don't have to worry about ammo in your house. And then you can get it shipped wherever you want it. So let's just say, you know, you're gonna be on vacation, you want your ammo shipped, I don't know, to Alaska. They'll send it. Go check out Ammo Squared. The link is down below. If you use that link, you'll get $20 of free ammo. Now, the other organization is one that's near and dear to my heart. It's Hold My Guns. Hold My Guns is helping gun owners in times of need. Now, what does that mean? It can mean anything from we have a mental health crisis in the house and we just need to get the firearms out of the house without getting the government involved. Get them out, take care of what you need, get them back, or maybe you're just selling your house. You just need to get the guns out because, well, people are touring your house. No problem. Go check in your guns at one of their storage partners. When you sell that house, get them back. Again, you don't need the government involved with this. Go check out Hold My Guns. Link is down below. Now it's time to talk to Nathan. Nathan, tell me about your love of guns.
Yeah, I'm Nathan Mitchell, the owner and founder of Mitchell Defense. I spent 6 years in the U.S. military as a recon corpsman. And then after that, I got out, went and did a few years in the oil field, running an oil field pipe inspection business. I also dabbled in restaurants and charter boat businesses and property management down in the Virgin Islands for a few years. But in 2019, started Mitchell Defense. And spent way longer than I wanted to in R&D, trying to figure out where we could find our mark inside the industry. And I think we did it because we focused on reliability, accuracy, and durability. And we make the best AR on the market. I don't know who else could compete with us.
Well, first of all, thank you for your service, because that was one thing that we talked a little bit about at SHOT. We met each other at SHOT through a mutual connection. And it was great. I love seeing people coming out of the military and then going into business for themselves. It's like one of the greatest things to see. And definitely thank you for your service.
Yeah, no, and it's in being in the firearms industry as a veteran-owned business, it's one, there are not very many veteran-owned firearms businesses. Most of the guys go into training or accessories that start their own businesses. So it's been interesting, especially like dealing with other owners of companies and like the C-suite people, like how little of knowledge that they have as far as like the use of firearms. And they're in charge of manufacturing them. It's like,
we have a joke on the media side, because, you know, we go around SHOT Show and it's like you go into a booth and there's someone you're looking at going, did you even graduate high school yet? Right. You know, they're young, and it's just, I'm getting older, so everybody looks younger now, right?
True.
And it's like, have you even shot the guns that you're marketing, right? And sometimes no. Sometimes these marketing people that are in these booths, they're not gun people. I mean,
oh no,
they know the technical stuff, but they don't know the real feel and function and everything of this thing. You start asking some deeper questions, they're lost.
Well, and like training side, it's like, I mean, there's maybe they've shot their guns like in their own like firing range. Like, oh cool, like they probably don't carry a gun, They don't like train. And like, I mean, the AR world, you can own one, but like, you need to train with it. Like, you need to know how to actually use it. But like, I always say this, it sounds gimmicky, but it's actually true. Like, our last QC step in building these rifles is, would you trust this rifle with your life? And like, actually knowing what that means to say yes.
Yeah. Cause that's a big thing coming out of military is you need to trust your gear and you need to trust the people next to you. Right. I mean, there's a lot of trust there because you are literally talking about your life and the life of everybody around you. And coming through with, you know, building a firearm, we're now talking about something that if a catastrophic failure of this piece of machinery happens, I mean, it's not pretty, right? I mean, we've seen, you know, bad ammo going through ARs, blowing AR uppers up and things like that. So that's, I don't think that's gimmicky. I think every firearm company should be asking that question when that firearm is finished. That should be the last question. Would I trust my life on this?
Yeah. No, and it's 100% should be the last question everybody's asking, but you see something, and not every company has government contracts. Like, we focus mostly on law enforcement and government customers. Like, that's my, cause that's just, I speak to those people better. Sure. We just recently started, I hired a few sales guys. They're going out and doing trying to connect with dealers and stuff. But, we focus on those groups just because, one, I mean, these rifles are designed to be used. Like, we don't make the crazy Cerakote, we don't do the colorful stuff and the weird engravings on the handguards and all the things that look good. We focus on like the actual internals of the rifle to make them operate with the reliability, accuracy, and durability, which are the three things that actually matter in a rifle.
See, and that's one thing that when I walked into your booth at SHOT, we were talking, and the first thing I did was picked up one of your rifles while you were talking, because, you know, I'm like, okay, it's another AR, right? Yeah. And then I pick it up, and then, you know, the first thing I did, I always test the upper and lower, and there's always a rattle. And I'm sitting there going, you're like sub-millimeter of movement between this. I mean, I'm like, okay, this is a tight rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'm playing with the barrel because usually you can get, you know, you can get a little bit of movement out of a barrel, not a lot, but a movement. I'm like, this barrel is tight. And I'm like, all right, they went out and tried to build a better mousetrap, right? I mean, anybody can build an AR. Building it right is something different. And, you know, talk to me about that, because you were talking about that's what you were going for. You're going for that reliability. You're going for building a better AR. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the process. How did you, you know, you saw that this is the market and you wanted to change that. Talk a little bit about that journey.
So this is just the Mitchell Defense story. When we actually first started, I was out in the oil field getting my master's degree, and it was a master's project. They told us to design a company to solve a problem, so on and so forth. So we had a bunch of engineers. We all got together and said, we're going to design a new armor piercing round for the government. And then we're like, wait, this is actually like something we can do. Like, there is a space for this. And I had the pipe inspection business, and we were going to use the facilities, all that stuff. So I think we started the company was like in March, I think. And then I ended up selling that pipe business in June. So we kind of, all the facilities left away. And then once I sold that business, my wife was like, we have to move back up north. And so just kind of like that dream kind of fell away. But through that process, being in the oil field, everyone always talks about aerospace when it comes to firearms. Yep. And in the machining side of it, aerospace is where you want to be. Those guys can hold extremely tight tolerances, and they also they're very good at aluminum. But when it comes to like coating technologies and your reliability and like your springs, your coatings, and I mean, even like the way we seat our barrels, I mean, that's oil field through and through. Those guys, I mean, oil fields put billions of dollars in research into how to keep wells up for a longer period of time, because when they're down, that's money. I mean, it's millions of dollars they're losing when that oil well goes down. So that's like, I mean, we use thermal fitting in the oil field, and that's how we thermal fit our barrels to our uppers, which we can talk more about in a second. Like the Armor Lube coating that we use, I mean, that coating was started in the oil field. And then like our spring technology and stuff, I mean, it's not stuff that hasn't been used in the gun industry. It's just not widely used because it's no one knows anything about it and like the actual science behind it. Like we had as a hydro tester, we used to reclaim pipe. And so we would pump that pipe up with like, I think it was like 10,000 pounds of pressure, like water pressure to make sure that it doesn't leak so it can go back down hole. And that's like that machine kept going down all the time. And we used to have to take that thing apart and put it back together. And that's where I learned like all the machining and manufacturing processes and like what tolerances we needed in order to keep that machine. And every 300 joints, we were having to take that machine apart and put it back together. And like, that's a full day's run. So, I mean, I took that machine apart hundreds of times until we figured out how to keep it up for like a month at a time. But so taking that in, and then after I sold the business, we moved back out here. I was trying to figure out where is the gap in the AR market. Well, I didn't know if I wanted to do pistols, ARs, or bolt guns. Definitely just didn't want to do pistols. I ran a Glock forever. I feel like Glock has perfected like the actual usability of a pistol. Yeah. There are gaps. Don't get me wrong. The triggers are terrible.
There's only so many things you can do to a Glock to make it better. Mm-hmm. They just work. They really do. They just work. I mean, there's some things that in the industry is doing now with grip angle and stuff, like trying to fix the ergonomics. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there's not much you can do to it, right? I mean, it was a pretty good design.
I just recently went out to Staccato too, and Staccato is like what I'm running for a pistol now. They're expensive pistols, don't get me wrong. We saw like the process, like manufacturing processes, and like what they do to them, and they have they've done a really good job of getting as close to a hand fit or 2011 as you possibly can without being hand fit. But I was impressed by it. I was kind of against Staccato for a little while, and then I saw their facilities and like the processes they go through. I'm like, all right, these are actually pretty nice handguns.
Once you saw the sausage being made, you were hooked.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And like you hear a problem. I mean, anyone who's mass producing anything, you're going to have some problems that are in there.
There's manufacturing defects in everything, right? Oh,
for sure. Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. And that's in something slipped through the cracks, but no, the Staccato makes a great handgun. It's kind of it's the pistol I'm running now. But yeah, so didn't want to get in the pistol industry. The pistols are pistols are so specific to the user as well. And that was where I kind of like steered away. It's like I can't make a better handgun because I have to make a better handgun for an extremely specific group of people. Yep. And it was just not my thing. looked at bolt rifles. Bolt rifles are probably, if you want to talk about a muckier or group of people,
it's worse than the AR market. It's pretty snotty.
It is, and it's worse than the AR market. I would rather try and break into the AR market like we did than bolt rifle. Which hey, we do bolt rifles. They're more like $8,000 bolt rifles though. They go over to Alaska, and I don't advertise it. Because that's a fun project for me. That's not a
you get into something where you take something you like to do and you turn it into work, and then you don't like doing it anymore. It's, mm-hmm. When I was in FFL, I was doing Cerakote work. I absolutely loved doing Cerakote work. It was one of the things is I was buying firearms off the surplus market, was rehabbing them, refinishing and reselling them, and I enjoyed doing that. The second that I started doing Cerakote work for my customers, I hated doing Cerakote work. It just killed me. It got to the point where my wife told me that she didn't like me doing Cerakote work because it made me miserable. Because I was a perfectionist. It had to be perfect. If this AR lower was not perfect, that lower and that upper were going right through the sandblast cabinet again and getting redone.
Oh yeah.
I totally get it. The second you take something that's fun and turn it into a job, it's a job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, the Cerakote wise, like we're moving to a new facility and we have our Cerakote booth and all that stuff. And it's going to be a totally separate side. Like I'm training a guy to come in to run like basically his own Cerakote company. Cause like we don't have the volume where we run Cerakote all day long. We can do so much volume of Cerakote faster than we can machine stuff out. But I'm like, I want nothing to do with it. I don't want to talk to customers. I don't want to. It's just like they come in. Some people come in with some. There's a company I met out in at an IB 88 that does Cerakote work, and that they do it right. But like they only do Cerakote and they only do like the kind of like they do like basic stuff. But like he's an artist, like and that's art. He takes very big much pride in it. Takes his time to do it right. I mean, we had a couple of side projects we're working on that I'm excited to get them off to him to do. But yeah, so reason we chose the AR market, kind of getting back onto that part. You start look like the AR market seems like it's flooded, and you're like, all right, there's no space in the AR market to really like kind of make your mark. Carbon fiber barrels just kind of started coming out. Proof Research kind of finally got it where they weren't just total trash.
Right.
And so we started looking into that. No one was really doing barrels like that. So like the first rifle that we came out with was a carbon fiber wrap barrel. And it was a quad rail. So it's kind of the Mark 110 sort of kind of a clone, I guess. I don't know. And so we started once we started working into that, you're like, all right, well, these barrels are extremely accurate. And then we started, I was like, well, we should thermal fit them. Like we learned about thermal fitting out in the oil field. I was like, why can't we use that technology? Cause like with the rifles, cause like it was, you're trying to design something that you're like, all right, everyone has like this weird barrel lockup with their barrel nut works to it. It's like, all right, well, let's design something that's better than that. Like what other people are doing. And everything you look at, you're like, all right, well, this adds a pound to the rifle. I was like, okay, well, we have to, these things still have to be lightweight, but they have to be super accurate. So it's like, all right, well, what can we use? And then one day it was just like what? I was thinking like, it's like, I can just thermal fit these things. Like, wait, why would that not work? And so that's whenever I came up with like our thermal fitting. It's like, oh, no one's doing this. Like, why is no one doing this? And I've kind of just determined that it's just because it takes too much time. That's why no one does it.
Well, the thing with thermal fit, it's not only that it takes time. It's not very hard. You just got to learn it. Yeah. So for the audience, thermal fitting, I got an upper right here that's blank. You have your upper, and then you have the barrel extension that goes into the AR upper. What you do is you actually have an oversized barrel extension. You heat the aluminum here. And then put that in, and then this thing just clamps right onto it. So you're almost making a mechanical connection, not quite, but almost. You're just making that so tight. But that's the thing, is that it's not hard to do. You just got to know how to do it. You guys are obviously are doing it to get that. You get the accuracy out of it, but I think that a lot of companies probably don't do thermal fit. Because number one, they don't understand it, and two, there's specifications, right? I mean, you obviously understand specifications. There's a plus and minus, right? Well, if let's just say it's plus, your barrel extension is minus two, and your receiver is plus two, so there's four between that. Mm-hmm. There's four units right there, so it's like. I think people don't do it because you have such a difference in manufacturing, right? If you're going to do thermal fit, you need to be a little more specific.
Extremely high tolerances.
Yeah, you need to keep those high tolerances. I think that's probably why people do it, because they're just buying stuff that's mass manufactured and they just want it to go together and get a product out.
Yeah. And so the way you were explaining thermal fitting with having the larger barrel extension, That's we do it the opposite. So we thicken the upper receiver, like the barrel seat in the upper receiver, because one of the things we were running into is that if with thermal fitting, if you have too much, well, if it's too small and you have to expand the metal too much, you'll get stress cracks.
Sure.
If it's not enough. So what we did was we thickened it up. So we get a little bit more range as far as what we can get before we start getting stress cracks. But it also makes it where you can use any barrel you want to. So like if you wanted to change it out. So like if you took like a regular barrel from, I don't know,
the XYZ company off the internet.
Yeah. You would still have a thermal fit upper if you're changing that barrel out.
Nice.
Yeah. So, it just made more sense to do it that way.
You're making your tighter tolerances here on the upper.
Yep.
That makes perfect sense because at that point, you're right. You can grab just about any barrel off the market.
Mm-hmm.
We can get oversized barrel extensions, but guys, putting a barrel extension onto a barrel, an AR barrel, is kind of, it's not fun. You need to know what you're doing because that's where your head spacing is happening.
Mm-hmm.
I like where you put that tighter tolerance on the upper.
Mm-hmm. And then with the billet uppers, we also, one of the things that adds accuracy is the barrel, like the face of the barrel seat is flat. It's like perfectly flat. Yep. So what that does makes it where you're like the lockup, your barrel is locked in there, but it also means it's that also barrel square. Is perfectly in line with your upper receiver. And that matters for a few things, like as far as like your reliability and the accuracy, and then also like the durability, but then your recoil management. But that bolt carrier group is going to be going perfectly in line. So the bolt carrier group is going to shoot back perfectly and then go straight home perfectly. And it's going to go in the same place every time where you don't have uneven wear. And that bolt is actually going to sit flush on the round when it locks in there.
So yeah, it's basically, it was funny, not so much, but kind of like it. It's almost like blueprinting in a bolt action, right? You got everything squared up and everything's ready to go. Because that's something that people don't understand. The first time I showed somebody how to, you square off this face.
Truing
it. Yeah. So when, I have a fixture to put in there, put my lapping compound, you lap the,
yeah,
lap
yeah,
the
face. Yeah.
When I start showing that, people are like, I don't understand why you're doing that. Like, that's why there's a difference between my builds and your builds right there. And I start explaining, and when you have a finished product and then you start lapping, you start seeing those high spots and low spots. I'm like, but that's machined. I go, yes, but you still have. There's still tolerant, just because you have a huge ass milling machine doesn't mean it's absolutely perfect, right?
Oh no, I'll check it. Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's like on our bolt carrier groups. I mean, we precision grind down the bolt carrier groups, and the reason we do that is because the CNC machines can only get so close.
Yep.
And precision grinding it's been around forever. No one uses it in this industry. But it gets to an exact tolerance. And I mean, that's an aircraft or aerospace.
See, and this is why it was great meeting you at SHOT is, everybody can make an AR. It's not hard to make an AR. God knows that I teach people how to make ARs. It's not hard. The problem is that most people don't understand how to make, an accurate AR with good tolerances. We grab a barrel, we slap a barrel in and all that. They don't know to true up that face, where the barrel meets.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know about thermal fitting to clamp that barrel in there. They don't understand. They look at a $600 rifle and they can't understand why this rifle is $600 and that rifle is $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference. Not that company is making that much more money on it. It's that company is putting that much more time and effort into that rifle to make it a better rifle.
Well, I feel like price should reflect quality. I don't think it actually does in the AR market very well. I think that irritates me. It's like our rifles are actually worth the amount of money that you're paying for them. I think some of my competitors that are even priced higher probably had the same quality as like a $1,200 rifle.
Yeah. I've seen that too.
You're paying for brand. I think there's very few AR companies. This is where like you kind of start to find the niche in the market. It's like they don't actually build quality rifles. They mass produce rifles.
Yes.
And they go off of the military standard. I mean, like a mil-spec is 6 MOA, like accuracy, which is like all terrible. Over the place.
It's terrible. That's terrible.
I think most AR companies are putting out 2 MOA rifles. And that's why like, they're like, oh, well, it's good enough for the government. Like they're going to sell. Like, and that's the, they don't put that extra finishing touch on it because they're like, it doesn't matter. No one, like they're still going to buy the rifle. It's like, yes, but like you can do better.
Yeah.
And then like, I mean, yeah. Like what?
No, I was just saying, yeah, absolutely. You can do better. And that's the thing is, I always like to say, like you build a 1911 and you assemble an AR. Mm-hmm. The difference between assembling an AR and building an AR, this is what we're talking about in this podcast now, right? We're now talking about building ARs, which means we're having those tighter tolerances, which means we're making a better product. We're making a more reliable rifle, more accurate rifle. This is what people don't understand, that there are choices to be made. You don't have to put up with a crappy rifle.
No, especially if you're building it too. It's you want to have the quality parts and the like, because when you start, building a rifle, you start matching uppers and lowers, and there's all kinds of stuff. Even the conversation between forging and billets, it's like it all of that stuff just gets so overwhelming, and then you start reading into like the forums and stuff, and those people are all over the place.
Well, you know, it's funny, they are. And it's so funny as you get into I've built so many ARs. I'm like, you may have assembled them, but you don't truly understand. But one of the things, you actually have a blog post on your webpage, which I absolutely love, was you were talking about the difference of barrel nuts, aluminum versus steel.
Yep.
And you got talking about, okay, we now have, it's
my rant about thermal expansion.
Yeah, it was probably the best description I've ever heard of about why you want a steel. I mean, you're talking about that thermal expansion. You talk about, how was it aluminum expands 4 times than steel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're talking about now and you think about it, you now have this steel insert going into an aluminum, an aluminum upper,
mm-hmm.
where you have steel holding it down. You're talking about that expansion. Well, that steel barrel nut is not letting that aluminum expand, mm-hmm. to make that barrel wobble. And it was such a great description about that. And I mean, this is why this is why you make the decisions that you do. You're not making a decision because everybody on this forum says this is the best way to do it. You actually have the science down of why you do the things that you do.
Oh, we do. And that was my big thing. There is not one part in these rifles that wasn't tested for a specific purpose. And because one, I'm just extremely OCD about that kind of stuff, but there's a bunch of like little things, but it's just like we thought through it in the sense of like, how does science tell us that this works? And then we went and tested it to see if it actually worked that way. Not versus just looking up on the forums and trying to figure out what everyone says is better, because a lot of it's like based on like one specific part, but like what people don't really think about, and they think about each individual part of a rifle, but they don't think about it as a system. It's a complete weapon system. Your barrel, barrel extension, the barrel nut, and then the upper receiver, that's a system. Those are 3 different parts that are working together to do the exact same thing. So like, I mean, we can argue about barrel nuts all day long, but if we're not talking about barrel nuts, upper receivers, and barrel extensions, we're not even having the same conversation.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so basically you guys became your own Mythbusters in order to develop your product.
Oh, we did. I mean, it, it, And that was like the thing, like you're trying to find your niche. It's like, okay, how do we make, so like I stepped back and I said, hey, all right, what are the things that actually matter in a rifle? And it's the internals. And so it's the accuracy, durability, and reliability. So when you look at those three things in a rifle, it's like, all right, we're not going to add anything that doesn't add to those three things, the three pillars of our rifles. And so you start looking at it. It's like, okay, well, like, how do we, with that standard, how do we improve upon what everyone else has done? And can we even improve? And so like accuracy, I mean, like our 16 inch rifles are getting half MOA accuracy out of them with match grade ammo. So it's like, okay, well, we got accuracy down. No one else is doing that. That I know of. And then like reliability wise, it's like, okay, well, let's define reliability. So like our definition of reliability is needing to be able to run 10,000 rounds, with zero failures, with no lube or cleaning to the bolt carrier group.
That's asking a lot.
And that was in, I don't even know where I came up with 10,000 rounds. That one probably just came out of the air. I was like, I don't think any rifle can run 10,000 rounds without failure. So like, that's what I want to go for. And then durability wise, it's like, look, we need to be able to drag these things behind a truck. Cause I mean, I know plenty of guys who, something happened, their gun got drug up on a lanyard and got drug behind their car. And then they end up stopping and have to get out, get their gun, and they're in a firefight. So it's like, okay, as far as durability wise, like you need to be, the rifle needs to be able to withstand torture. And so, yeah, that was kind of I had a point I was trying to make in there. I don't remember what it was.
We were talking about the, you know, now I forget where we were too. We were talking about the whole why, you know, you became your own myth buster to build this thing.
Oh yeah.
And thinking of everything as a system, because that's I like where you go with that, because a lot of people think when they build a gun, a lot of people look at looks, right? Mm-hmm. I want to have this barrel. Why? Because it's a $50 barrel. That's what I can afford. Mm-hmm. Okay. You realize it's not the greatest barrel in the world, but they will spend $300 on a free float tube. It's like, I would rather you switch your money.
Yep.
Right. Put the money into that barrel, get a cheaper free float tube, and then upgrade the free float tube later when you have the money. Right. They don't think of this as a system. And that's where I love where you got what you were just talking about. We were talking about a barrel, and you're like, this is a system of three components: the barrel extension, you know, and ultimately the barrel, the upper receiver, and the barrel nut. You said these three things work together as a system. And a lot of people don't talk like that. It's a barrel nut.
Yep.
Not to you guys. you went through and said, no, this is sure, we need a barrel nut. You absolutely, in an AR, you need a barrel nut to hold this thing together. Mm-hmm. But what, you know, you went, why? You know, because of this. So that is just, I mean, we just talked about the barrel attachment. You already talked about grinding, you know, doing the grinding on your bolt carrier, your bolts, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so you even went beyond the bolt to the spring. I mean, your spring is complete, and that's when we were talking in your booth. I was even playing with the spring. You were showing me the spring. Talk mm-hmm. a little bit about the spring.
So our buffer springs are kind of a, so between the bolt carrier group and the buffer spring, the reason we get the insane reliability that we get, it's because those two units work like just hand in hand with each other. So the spring itself, we use a flat wire spring, which flat wire technology has been around the gun industry for a while. It never really seemed to take off, but as far as like spring technology, flat wire springs hold more, energy than what like a round wire spring does. They also stack on top of each other, so you can have a longer spring, versus, well, hold on one second. Let me go grab one.
Yeah.
For spring, I'm talking significantly longer. I mean, so you see how much bigger the spring is. That kind of showing it.
I'll bring you a full screen here.
Yeah.
So look at that.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's longer. It's a lot longer.
You can see where you can see it the most right there, because you're talking about probably at least 2 inches there.
Yeah. Well, and then like I actually have never counted the coil. We have 35 coils in our springs. I don't know what's on a regular carbine spring. I know we have significantly more. I could count it one day. But what that does is that flat wire spring will stack on top of it while holding more energy. But one of the big deals is like regular carbine spring lasts about 8,000 cycles before it starts to lose springiness. And that's because of the way the round wire it holds energy and it starts to lose. Our springs will last about 200,000 cycles before it starts to lose springiness. Between that and then also it gives 30% more forward pressure to the bolt carrier group. So what that's doing is it's absorbing more recoil. So your rifle stays flat the entire time, but it's giving that 30% more forward pressure. So no matter how dirty your rifle gets, it's still pushing past it and stripping those rounds out. 9 out of 10 failures happen because your magazine's too dirty or like the bad feeding. So it just solves that problem. No matter what mag you're putting in there, it's still just grabbing those rounds and pulling them out.
So, I mean, that goes back into that systems thinking again. You're now talking about, you know, we've already talked about the barrel attachment. We've talked about the interface of the bolt carrier to the barrel. Now you're talking about guaranteeing that interface by using a different spring, by using, again, science. You know, you're talking about, you know, 30% more energy being stored up in a spring. I mean, that was a lot of things. I mean, you know, I think about when I do testing, I have I don't even have it in here. It's in the safe right now. I have a 308 AR that I do testing on. It's got a adjustable gas block that I have that thing wide open. Right. So that thing is just sending everything back. Of course, it's sending all the gas. I use the cheapest ammo in the world to do that with. Right. So I have my bolt carrier slamming back. It's getting dirty and it's slamming all that gook right into the barrel. This rifle finds problems with people's products. It could be an optic, it could be a scope mount, it can be a magazine. This combination works for me for testing. Now, I was testing a cleaning. You know, somebody gave me some cleaning stuff. I just wanted to know that, you know, is it really better than somebody else's? So I take my dirtiest rifle and ran that thing to failure, right? Because, I mean, I'm looking at it right now. It was Bernal ammo. I mean, the cheap, really, really cheap stuff.
Yeah.
Right? If you could clean this rifle, that rifle failed. It failed in about 600 rounds with this ammo.
Wow.
So it was the nastiest thing in the world. All I did is I opened up my rifle, sprayed this stuff in, closed it up, and I was back in business again. So that's what I love. You know, we think of the M16 when it first came out. It went to Vietnam. It was notorious for failures, right? Mm-hmm. That's why they came up with the forward assist. Now you have more energy, you have 30% more energy pushing that bolt carrier forward. We have less reliance on that forward assist now.
Oh yeah. I was demoing for the other day. Like someone asked me like what the forward assist is for. And I was like, oh, let me show you like what like the thought process is. And like I was like trying to like hold it in there where it's like holding it back and then like showing them like the forward assist, but then like it just wouldn't do it. I was just like, all right, this shows why the
forward assist kept on locking up like you did.
Yeah, it just kept closing. Yep. I was just like, just for a second, hold.
So that's what I love about it, because that feeds into the reliability pillar of your rifles. Is now you're starting to get that bolt close. Now you're also talking about running them dry. And when I talk to a lot of people that came in from, you know, the desert from war, you know, I remember talking to one person and it blew my mind. It made sense once he explained it to me. It blew my mind that his M9, he ran his M9 dry, no lube, his M4, no lube. And it blew my mind. I'm like, but he goes, no, you don't understand the but.
about sand.
That sand is so fine and gets in everything. The second you lube something, you have a failure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, but it wasn't designed for it. He goes, we didn't care if it was designed for it. That's the only way we could get these things to run in that environment. Now that you have, you know, the coating on this stuff to start, you know, helping with that and running these things dry, you don't care. You're at the point where you don't care what the environment is. You're getting that reliability because now we have, you know, all these other systems, and then you put a coating on top of it to help, you know, that system mm-hmm. run.
Oh yeah, so the bulk carrier groups, I mean, is what you're talking about. The coating that we use on the bulk carrier groups is called Armor Lube. It was developed with the armor. It was developed out in the oil field, but the Army Research Center kind of helped perfect it. It's now the new mil-spec standard for the M4 bulk carrier group. It blows my mind that there aren't more companies that are offering it out to the civilian population, because any government contract is running this stuff. But I think we're one of two companies that are actually offering it. And then I know that the other company is priced at about twice what we are for bulk carrier groups. Armorly bulk carrier group, one of the tests they ran was taper abrasion testing. During that testing, taper abrasion testing is like basically taking sandpaper to it and seeing how long the coating will last. That coating lasted 97,000 cycles. The Armor Lube did. The next closest was nitride, which is like 25,000 cycles. And then I think phosphate lasts like 800 cycles, which is phosphate's like what used to be the mil-spec standard.
It used to be a standard. Yeah.
And what most companies are still putting in their rifles today. It's still, I don't know, it blows me away that people are still using phosphate coating.
That's what I love about you with the Armor Loop. So when I was doing Cerakote work, I used MicroSlick. That was their, it's good. It's not great. It doesn't wear, you know, it doesn't wear as long as I would think it would. But it's really great when it's there because almost guarantees that lubrication. Now you're talking about, there's no way MicroSlick would ever last. Was it 90,000 is what you're?
97,000.
97,000. No way MicroSlick would ever last that long. I can tell you I have bolts in my rifles that are probably 2,000 or 3,000 that they're shiny spots. So I love that you're putting this code. This is where, you know, when we were talking about this stuff at SHOT, I love that you're putting that coding in. You're mm-hmm. looking at that coding. You're looking for that reliability. These are, again, mm-hmm. the things this is now the mil-spec, but everyone's still doing the old stuff.
Oh yeah. And it's extremely expensive to coat. And that's why I don't think most companies are using it for like the civilians. I mean, government customers are passing that cost off to them. The friction coefficient on the Armor Lube is extremely low. It's an advanced DLC. So one of the biggest issues with DLC is that it's very hard to get on the internals. So mm-hmm. The Army loved about this, what I love about it too, is the DLC handles heat better than chrome lining does. So it eliminates the need to chrome line for full auto rifles on the inside. And a lot of companies we actually mill the bulk carrier groups to compensate for the lack of chrome lining. A lot of times if you're buying them from whatever the major bulk carrier group companies are, they're going to be milled for chrome lining. So like, it's, you're still going to have like that tight lockup. I mean, it's not that thick, but like, it's still something. And especially when it comes to like gas leakages and all that kind of stuff. But
it's funny you think about that, because I wouldn't have thought about the chrome lining of a bolt carrier. Mm-hmm. You know, even though I do Cerakote work and we talk about mills and we're adding so many mills. That would make perfect sense that you would have that, because you know that's one of the things where I used to have stuff right here. I cleaned up and you know I can't find anything right. Starting to test companies like on pistols with PVD coatings on barrels and slides, I go, there's no way Cerakote's going to last this long. I mean, as much as I love Cerakote, it's just not going to last that long, right? I mean, I have slides and barrels and stuff that I'm barely seeing wear on. So now we have a PVD coating that's slick, right? Mm-hmm. That you're using on that bulk carrier. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
We used to use nitrided coating on the original design, but we kept getting wear on the rails in the front and back for some weird reason, like really bad wear, especially with the anodizing. Mm-hmm. That was like when we were like, all right, we got to find something that's different. But like you're talking about like Cerakote. So most companies use H series Cerakote. That's the standard for the industry. We use E series, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with there.
Yeah. It's the new enhanced. That's the enhanced coatings.
Yeah. So it's harder. It's slicker. It's better corrosion resistance there. They're actually using it on SpaceX is using it on their space shuttles. But so like between like the bulk carrier group and then our upper receiver and the coating inside of there, there's near zero friction to that. So once those rails kind of like find their home, which straight out of the box, the things are extremely smooth, like just like butter. But once it starts kind of getting like that, like the everything kind of wears itself in. I mean, that thing, it's legitimately like there is no friction to it whatsoever. And like that, I mean, that helps with everything.
So that also adds to your pillar of reliability to it.
Oh yeah. So there's two. I mean, you have the website you can pull up, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Let me pull
if you can pull it up and go to the bulk carrier groups and part.
Sure. Let's go to parts. Of course, my computer's running slow here. You want the enhanced bulk carrier group right there, right?
Yep, that one.
There we go.
So one of the pictures, you can see the screws that we use for the gas keys. They're the oak screws for the optimized carrier keep screws. So, I mean, they're like that's just another thing that we do. So we seal the gas key for gas leakage, but then we also, whenever we stake these, I mean, the screws themselves have rivets in them. So that metal is actually getting pushed inside the screw. So it's almost impossible for these screws to back out.
That's like we were talking about earlier. That's not a friction lock. That's a mechanical lock at that point.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And that's like, how often do carrier keys come loose? Not very often, but when you're talking about running these things for thousands and thousands of rounds, like it's something that you have to take into consideration.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, like you were talking about, you have law enforcement and that type of, you have that type of mentality out there and those people are running these things hard. Mm-hmm. Where you're literally talking like you're talking before, would you trust your life to this gun? That's one other thing right there that I would trust my life. I don't care that I've never seen a carrier key come loose, right? I know that I know it's happened. Mm-hmm. But you're sitting there going, even that small percentage is too much. How do we cut that back even more? Mm-hmm. So that way we have less of a possibility of a failure.
Oh yeah. I mean, then you start looking at and this is another thing that we do on these bulk carrier groups that we are the only company that does this. I know this for a fact. We coat our gas rings. So if you think about the friction point inside of a bulk carrier group, you have the rails. Those are the only things that are actually touching inside the upper receiver, but then your gas rings are the only between the gas rings and then the inside of the bolt carrier group, that bolt locking and unlocking. That's really the only friction point that you have inside there. And that thing has extreme heat that goes to it and then rubbing against it. And that's like, that is what you get your reliability for. So like our gas rings will last about four times longer. I know I have rifles that have like 30,000 rounds in them and that bolt carrier group, I mean that it still will stand on its own.
And for everybody out there, I'm sorry for everybody in the audio side, but for everybody on the video side, I'm going to hold one up. That's a gas ring right there. I mean, he's talking about something that small that he's taking attention to detail where they're coating it. And yes, this is right out of my parts bin here and they're not coated. They're just regular gas rings.
Yeah. Stainless steel gas rings. I mean, it's, and, yeah, I mean, that's like, that's just like another thing. It's just like, you find a failure point and then you try and fix it, and like an easy thing to do. And like, it also, with the coating on there, the coating itself has, it actually has less friction than the, Armor Lube does. If this coating, you could, there's other issues that was with it as far as like actually doing the full bulk carrier group. I mean, between the Armor Lube coating that actually makes it to the inside of the carrier and these gas rings that are rubbing on there, I mean, there's near zero friction to it. I mean, they will stand up on their own. I mean, there's no gas leakage and it's actually fit properly. But like, as far as the locking and unlocking part of it, I mean, it's just gliding.
Yeah. See, that's cool. Cause I keep going back to when I think of my bolts, and actually two of them are getting ready to get re-microslick now. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, it's great when the coating's there, but now there's the shiny part, so that means there's no coating there.
Yeah.
Right. So it's gotta be recoating. That's where you have the advantage with your stuff, is that, again, with that Armor Lube, it's 97,000 actions.
Yeah.
Some of my bolt carriers, they're probably running about 5,000, 5,000 rounds. And that's not including, me cycling it. They've been shiny for a while.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, and you start thinking about reliability too. So like I mentioned like how we define reliability, and 10,000 rounds. And that was like what we tested everything out to. Everything ran the way it was supposed to. Up until recently, hadn't ran a full blown test, like how long they would actually go. But like with near zero friction on the coating on the upper receiver, there's no friction on the bolt carrier group. When there's no friction without, I mean, lube is a big issue, because lube will it attracts dirt, like we were talking about with the sand. But like if there's no near zero friction, that means there's not enough stuff for the actual dirt to connect to, like on a micro level. And so like the dirt's just getting pushed out constantly, and it's not actually like sticking inside of those things. So I mean, the last endurance test that we actually ran, this is independent, we didn't run this internally, ran 17,554 rounds without cleaning or lube before we saw the first failure. And I think that far blows any other rifle system out of the water.
Yeah, that's huge. Cause it's funny, we've been talking about dirt. And dirt getting in, a couple of years ago, I live in Montana and it gets awfully cold here in the wintertime. I actually took some lube. This was 2 years ago. I did this video. Usually about a week a year, at least a week a year, our highs are still in the negatives. Like our high for the week is still in the negatives. And it gets really cold. So I had five little like plastic cups of lube that I put outside for a week. And the morning I pulled it in and did the video, it was negative 37 Fahrenheit. It was cold.
That's cold. It's very cold.
That's cold. I mean, trust me, when you get to like negatives, it's just cold. Mm-hmm. But negative 37 is damn cold. And I brought in some of that lube was frozen, flat out frozen.
Oh, wow.
Some of it was like a slushy. There was only one lube that was truly still liquid. So when we start talking about lube, now that's an extreme, right? Now, if I can run a rifle without lube, I don't have a rifle freezing up.
Oh, yeah.
If I have a rifle without lube and it's raining, I'm not worried about the lube washing out of the gun, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I have a rifle with that tight of a coating, I don't have it, it's so hard that I don't have to have lube onto that surface to keep the water off of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have rust. I mean, there are so many things with just having that Armor Lube on there that, I mean, we're just scratching the surface right now of just the little things.
Oh yeah.
I just don't have to worry about as a gun owner.
Yeah. And that's it. That's like the whole point is just like, you should be able to trust this thing. And there shouldn't be like some crazy maintenance schedule that you have to have for your rifle that most people don't actually know how to use or do.
So you have a rifle that can go from the Arctic to the equator in a day and run.
Oh yeah. Reliably awesome. Run.
Reliably yep. run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had, I don't know if you know, Michelle Wheeler. She's a MMA fighter. So she's just now she's getting into the tactical games. So she's running our rifles now. Her and her husband were running it, and Josh, her husband, he said he texted me the other day, and he was like, before the thing, he was like, dude, we were warming up or whatever, like the day before, it was raining, it was muddy. He's like, the rifles got so dirty, and he was like, I didn't bring a cleaning kit, and he's like, I was so concerned that these things weren't gonna run. And he was like, yeah, we ran them flawlessly through the entire tactical games. He's like, we aren't good shooters. We were engaging targets out to 400. He said we had no failures whatsoever. And he said everyone else was having failures left and right. I was like, yes. I
was about to say, I'm getting really jealous right now. Because I know my rifles wouldn't do that.
And like our pipe hitter line. So we have three lines. We have the Rat Dog, which is our 9mm, the PCCs. The Doc, which is our AR-15 platform, which is the ones we've mostly been talking about. But then we also have the pipe hitter, which is like our 308s, 6.5 Creedmoors, and 8.6 Blackout. And that we had a guy who's running competitions with the 6.5 Creedmoor and the gas gun. And he was telling me that, and he's over in Indiana, and he was saying that it's the only rifle that's been on the line gas gun wise that didn't have failures the entire competition. I think and it was only like 100 rounds. I think it was like his last competition.
Okay. You know, I'm going to bring the webpage up here. I was looking at, because I pulled the pipe hitter up. And you have this on several of the things. You know, you have I love this line, 100% American made and full auto capable.
Yeah. Most people don't know what that actually means, but yeah.
I mean, that's it. And we were talking earlier about you're running E-Series Cerakote on top of Type 3 hard coating anodized.
Yeah. I don't know if how familiar everybody is with like anodizing, but anodizing, it's a metal treatment. So like it affects the metal at a molecular level, and it actually is inside the actual metal, but it creates a very porous outside to it. Especially whenever you do like a clear coat. A clear coat and leave it open without sealing it. And then you put the Cerakote on top of that, and it binds to the anodizing better than it does just the raw metal. So you have a much, it's a harder finish, but it's also more durable.
Because Cerakote likes a rough finish. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when I first started doing Cerakote, the guidance was, at least back then, you needed that, like if you had an AR, you wanted that thing down to bare metal. Didn't matter what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to know, if you really truly want to understand, you know, the types of hard coating, start doing Cerakote work in a sandblaster booth. You know, you get into the like the type 2 and that coating's coming off. Mm-hmm. When you hit something that's type 3 hard coated, you are having one sucky day at the sandblast booth.
Oh, yeah.
Because it takes forever to get that thing down to shiny metal. And then later on, the guidance became, all you need to do is just dull the coating and mm-hmm. then Cerakote over top of it. And that's basically what you have is you have this really nice hard surface with another coating on top of it. It's, yeah. Even if you run through the Cerakote, you still got that type 3 hard coating underneath of it.
Oh yeah.
Not that aluminum's going to rust, but still you're talking about a longevity of a product at that point.
Yeah. Well, I mean the coating, I mean, aluminum's not going to rust, but like the coating's really there for the reliability piece to it as far as like the lubricity. It's not even like a corrosion issue.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I have a couple of AR lowers that are still in the white just because I had a project I needed to do for a video. Every once in a while in my videos, you'll see a nice Cerakoted upper on top of a of a raw aluminum lower because that's just what I had available at the time. I don't care because it's aluminum. I wasn't worried about it, that, you know, and it was a lower. It's not like I have that bolt carrier rolling inside, you know. But you're right. It's not, you're not worried about that, but it absolutely does help with the function.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, it's a key piece to it. I mean, it's a system. Like, any of these things by themselves would help the rifle a little bit, but like it put them all together and then you get 17,554 rounds. I mean, it's a weapon system.
But that's a rifle that for somebody who cleans as little as I do and stuff. Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting there thinking about what you're talking about, the competition shooter where they're like, it was raining, mm-hmm. it was muddy. I mean, you could almost just take a garden hose to it and then run it.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're really worried
about it.
We ran SHOT Show, the Range Day at SHOT Show. And then we just did the gathering out in South Carolina. And we didn't even clean the rifles between the two shows. And Ron, the guy who was running at the gathering, he tried to clean them up. And he's like, I was like dreading having to clean these rifles. He said, then I just pulled the bolt carrier group out and everything just fell right off. And I was like, yeah, it should just wipe off. Like, it's not you don't even need cleaning solution.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get, so what you're saying is you don't have to have the Hoppy's 9 headache.
Oh yeah. No, you're not sitting there just spraying stuff down and soaking it for hours. And I hate cleaning rifles. That's like my personal preference. We have an ultrasonic cleaner that, like, when we actually need to clean something, we run it through the ultrasonics and just call it a day.
I swear the person that created an ultrasonic cleaner, when they designed it, knowing that there was you had an AR or M16 bolt carrier in mind when they did it. Because I remember the first time I got and it was just a little like Harbor Freight one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time I cleaned my bolt carrier. I'm like, let's see what this thing does. I mean, this thing was spotless. I dropped that thing into that, and I was amazed at the stuff that was still coming out of it.
Oh yeah. You start to see like out of like the pores and all that stuff, and like it's just like, ooh.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you can't hand clean a gun well enough that an ultrasonic cleaner won't find. I mean, the ultrasonic cleaners goes down to like the actual like pores of the metal,
right?
I mean, it's
lifting stuff right off of the surface.
Oh yeah, and you have to put lube on it immediately after ultrasonic cleaning because like you have to fill those pores with something.
Yeah, it's funny. I had it's a 1911 frame, but one of the things I found when I was working on guns for people was you grab a 1911, and I would hear people talk about, you know, oh, I would just throw this into a ultrasonic cleaner. I would pull off the mainspring, and the little cup in there was. It was all rusted out because it's a cup. So people would pick this up and it's mm-hmm. sitting there. Okay, cool. While there's water sitting down in that cup.
Yeah. You got to use that ultrasonic lube after you do ultrasonic cleaning. Yeah. It's got to push all that water out.
Yep. You got to be careful when you're doing those ultrasonic cleaners.
Oh, for sure.
So, well, we've been rolling for about an hour. You know, Nathan, how do people find you? I mean, how do they find, you know, Mitchell Defense and more information about your products.
So MitchellDefense.com, that's the website. Our media site, if you want to just do a deep dive, I mean, I know we talked about some of the articles and stuff. I try and write stuff occasionally and like a deep dive into the theory behind why. So if you ever want to just do a deep dive into why, that's the media section of our website. It's a great place to look. But you can find all of our firearms. We just recently, in the last like couple of months, started doing like our bolt carrier groups, our upper receivers. You can get matched upper lowers from us. And then I think that's really all we are doing as far as parts. And then you can get complete upper receivers. Our Instagram, that's kind of like our main social media. It's Mitchell_defense. And then our YouTube, which is severely lacking. But we have a YouTube.
a YouTube that doesn't like your content.
No, yeah, we put no effort into YouTube. We got to do more on YouTube, especially more like actually like explaining stuff versus like the actual written stuff. But there are two Mitchell defenses, just so everybody knows. We are the Mitchell _ defense on Instagram. There's a Mitchell defense that is not us. It's pretty clear of why it's not us. If you go to it,
you know, I'm gonna be looking at that the second we're done is to find out what that is.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting one. I follow them and I'm like always constantly like wanting to comment on their stuff, but I'm just like, nope, hold back.
And for everybody either watching or listening, we'll have the links down in the description so that way you can get to the right one. So if you're driving back and forth to work, don't try to write this stuff down. Just come back to the podcast, go down to the description, and the links will be right there.
Yep. So, and then we also have a discount code for anyone's listening or watching. It's SiteWide20, 20% off. And it's good till the end of May.
Good deal. Good deal. Yeah. Hey, look, everybody loves a discount, right?
Oh, yeah. Especially 20%. That's a pretty good discount.
Especially 20. Yeah. 20% is a good discount.
Yeah.
So, well, we get to the end here. We've been talking about a lot of stuff. It's time to just kind of just relax a little bit and have some fun. So, we like to do a speed round at the end. So, it'll be four this or that questions and then one thinking question. And I'm going to change things up here. So usually I do a 223 versus 308. How about now? Let's throw a 308 versus 6.5 Creedmoor.
Ooh,
that's going to throw a lot of hate out there.
All right, so, man, that's so mission dependent. But I'll make it
easy for you.
Okay.
You go to the gun range, and you know, sitting there are two pipe hitters. One's in 6.5 Creedmoor and one's 308. Which one are you picking up first?
So if we're just at the range, 6.5 Creedmoor, it's more accurate. Reaching out to 1,000 with a 6.5 Creedmoor, it's super easy. You don't really have to, I am just absolute terrible at calling wind. And with a 6.5 Creedmoor, you don't have to do it. So like, if I'm reaching out and trying to touch something is like in a range scenario, 6.5 Creedmoor.
Okay. So let's see here. How about you walk up to a table and there's two ARs sitting there. One's a 5.56 and the other one's a 9mm. What's the one you're picking up first?
Oh, another capabilities question too. So I probably 5.56. I or the 223. Nine mils work really good inside of like 100 yards.
Right.
But I mean, I just a good suppressed 5.56 223 rifle, just it's money.
Yeah. It's,
I also have more experience on those.
Well, 9mm's fun, right? I mean, it's definitely a fun gun, but really, if I was going to pick something up, I would be the same way. I'd pick up the 5.56 every time.
Yeah.
That's not to say is when I run out of ammo that I'm still going to pick up the 9mm and shoot that too.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I would pick up the rat dog though. The 9mm on the rat. I mean, it has like no recoil to it. So like it, I don't know.
It's a fun gun.
It's a fun gun.
Yeah.
Fun for competition and stuff too.
So for hearing protection, earmuffs or earplugs?
Oh, earmuffs through and through. I can't do plugs.
Yeah, I had a problem with plugs when I was a kid. I think my problem was I had them as a kid. They were the fitted earplugs, and I just grew, right? So they just never worked for me. So I always grabbed muffs. Lately, I've been going back to plugs. I have a set of molded plugs now that are electronic that I really love. But if like, I don't know, if I'm going out to cut grass or something, I always grab the muffs.
They're hotter. And like I've been wanting to try some electronics, like the molded ones, just because I mean I love the electronics of like the earmuffs. mean, running in helmets and stuff. I mean, it's just, you always, I've always had the earmuffs on, but I mean, sometimes those hot range days, like I'd putting plugs in it. And if it, if you still get the, like the benefit of being able to hear everything around you, it's like the one thing I hate at ranges. Like whenever you have like the ear muffs and the ear plugs, like you can't hear things around you. Like I'm like constantly looking around, like trying to see if someone's trying to shoot me.
I took somebody out for their first time ever shooting. There was over the summer, and I grabbed muffs for them, right? Electronic muffs, because I'm gonna make sure they're running electronics so they can hear me, especially being a new shooter, you know. And having that situational awareness at the range is you can't beat it, right?
Well, maybe I have like a conversation with a person next to you and not like having to pause every time like a gun goes off and yelling at each other.
Those electronics, they're so advanced now that you can just keep talking and the person can keep hearing you over the gunshots.
Oh yeah.
They're that good now. I mean, before it used to be like a gun would go off and they'd cut.
Yeah.
And
now they just keep it all blended out.
Yep.
I love the once I started putting electronic ones on, I was like, there's no going back.
Yeah. So for pistol, 9mm or 45?
9mm. I'm looking at this from a pure like home defense standpoint. The advancements in home defense ammo for a 9mm, it's gonna get the job done. I mean, people always say carrying more, but like, I mean, if I'm in a firefight where I'm having to shoot 16 rounds or 15 rounds out, I don't know who's in my house, but there is more people than need to be in there. I just, the reduction in recoil, I don't know. 9mm is just my.
There's a lot of advantages to the 9. I mean, there's been a lot of debate over 9 over 9 and 45 for carry. It really depends on your point of view, but if you think about it. You know, I've been shooting, 42 years now, a little over 42 years now. The 9mm from when I was a kid versus the 9mm that's out now, there's been so many advances in bullets that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a lot of these older debates from when I was a kid, they don't hold up anymore.
No. This is my purely my standpoint on like when you're talking about like a carry gun, it doesn't matter 45, 9mm. The best carry gun is the one that you can shoot well. If you shoot a 45 better and you shoot a 9mm, carry a 45. But if you're carrying a 45 and you shoot a 9mm better, it's like because of the ammo, it's like that's not a valid argument anymore.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I mean, I've always said I would rather someone carry a 22 than a 45 if the 22 is what they can shoot the best.
Yeah.
Is it the best defense gun ever? No. But it's what they can control, so it is the best for that person.
Oh yeah, I mean if you can't put 3 rounds into somebody relatively quickly, like that's probably not the gun you need to be using, or you need to train more.
Yeah. Or you need to train more. I love that. I love that you put that caveat in there.
Yeah.
No matter how much training we do, we can always get more, right?
I mean, I think, and this is like, so Pennsylvania, so Texas, you had like for concealed carry, you had to go take a test. And like, I don't think it should be mandated by the state because I think that just kind of infringes on whatever. But I think everyone should want to be doing some kind of a training, like learning how to do their draws, how to like present like the deadly force continuum. I mean, if you're in a situation like that where it's life or death, I mean, you're not thinking, you're going to probably shoot yourself on the draw. And so like, I think everyone should do at least one training a year, but like Pennsylvania, like they don't have like any, like there's like no rules. Like you don't have to like prove that you know how to shoot a gun or you own a gun to get a concealed carry, which like it should be that way. But like, I also think that everyone should go and do their own training on their own.
And that's the thing a lot of people don't understand. Well, I don't say a lot. It's newer gun owners don't understand. Even some older gun owners don't understand is that shooting is a perishable skill.
Oh, yeah.
And then we're only getting older, right? We're never getting younger. We're only going to get older. Our reflexes, we know that our reflexes are going to get slower over age, over time. We need to train with that. We need to do that. It's, you know, I grew up just outside of Philly. And it was so funny when I moved to Montana, and this is where I got my first concealed carry permit. Well, technically my only concealed carry permit was here in Montana. Yeah, we had a class and we had to prove competency, and then we could get our concealed carry permit. I think about this is that my mom still lives on, you know, in Pennsylvania. And it's just like, she, you know, I tell her about that. She goes, I went down to the sheriff's department, paid them money, got my fingerprints, and I was done.
Yeah. Like,
but I agree with you. There is a need for continual training. Even if it's you just do dry firing in the house, is better than nothing at all.
Oh yeah. I mean, even like thinking through your house, like if you're like doing like a dry run through your house, I mean, I'd get the Mantis system. I mean, those things are amazing as far as dry fire.
I have a bunch of Mantis gear. And it's awesome. This stuff is just great.
Oh yeah. I mean, and like the AR side of it, I mean, they have the Blackbeard system that resets the triggers. I mean, like that, I have learned more about shooting on that Blackbeard system than I ever have in any training I've ever done.
I had the Blackbeard, and then later on I got the Blackbeard X. So it basically had the X10 system into it, so I could hook it up into the phone. And you learn so much. I'm thinking Laser Academy from Mantis. Now we just turned this into a complete Mantis commercial. I played with this episode by
Mantis.
Yeah, there you go. I'll have to talk because I know the guys over at Mantis. I beta tested the version 2 of Laser Academy,
mm-hmm.
and what they did. I mean, you now have a class inside Laser Academy.
Oh yeah.
People just go buy it. It's a great system.
Well, especially like your argument for like not like training is ammo. It's like, okay, well, for a box of ammo, you can go buy a Mantis, which I don't actually even know what they cost. But I mean, it's like you can train without shooting. But going back to like the concealed carry type stuff, it's like if you are shooting in a house, if you're shooting in like a public area, there's a lot of things that have to go through your mind before you pull the trigger. And like the only way that you're going to be able to react to that appropriately in a stressful situation is training. And like, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to that are like, oh yeah, if I was in whatever, there's a shooting, like I'm going to go and take him down. I'm like, yeah, well, that's legitimately how you get shot.
The problem you have with that thinking is that under stress, we don't result to our highest mastery of a subject. We resort to our lowest mastery of a subject.
Mm-hmm.
So you want that lowest mastery to be as high as possible, because that's where you're going to be operating. It's like, we've had this discussion on this podcast before. We talk about the difference between between defending yourself and competition shooting. They're different.
Oh, very different.
Right? There are some skills that transition over. But like I think of when I used to compete in USPSA, my walls were snow fence. I could still see my target. I could cheat. But if I had to defend myself in my house, I can't see through that wall.
So, or your neighbor's house. I mean, depending on how neighbor's house is together.
So, definitely a huge advocate for additional training. So, we'll move on to your last question, which is the thinking question.
All right.
So this is going to create a conflict of want versus need. I'm going to take you to the world's largest armory. It has one of anything that has ever thrown a projectile, with the exception of Mitchell Defense rifles, because you already have them. So for everybody else, they're there. But for you, we took them out because you're kind of biased in your opinion.
Yeah, that would make this conversation a little bit easier.
Yeah, it'd make it easier. So it has one of anything that has ever thrown a projectile. It could be anything from Dennis the Menace's slingshot to the deck guns off the Missouri. And it's been cleared by every possible government agency in the world that you can have one of anything in here. What are you taking home?
It's actually a pretty easy one. My grail gun is the MP7.
Okay.
Good old H&K. I love that gun. I think it's just cool. It's about as accurate as like a rifle in a very, very small platform. But that's just one that's like, and I think it's just because it's so hard to find one.
It
has to be full auto.
Of course it would. I mean, why would you have one that's not?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's probably the one I would go with.
So I'll tell you, you are not the first person to take an MP7 home on that question.
Yeah.
That has come up a few times. A couple of people have chose the MP5 over the MP7, but they all have the same basic mentality, and they were all full auto. I mean, obviously. Just can't not have the fun switch, right?
No. I shoot full auto a lot, but there's something about it. It's still fun. It doesn't matter if I've done it 100 times. I mean, we even doing some of the reliability testing, like burning it down testing. I mean, it was still fun. I still had a good time with it.
Yeah. It's, range day at SHOT is always fun for me, is that I always have to stop by and play with a giggle, at least one giggle switch. Right. Mm-hmm. I had somebody on, she's actually from Slovakia, and she was talking about, the first time that she shot full auto. Oddly enough, it was here in Montana. And I go, "Oh, you have to play with a giggle switch." And she's like, "Giggle switch?" I go, "Yeah. When you shot that full auto." She goes, "Oh, I get it. Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a lot of giggles afterwards." I mean, the first time anybody ever shoots full auto, they all have the same, they have that same smile, right? That same laugh.
Oh yeah. No, it makes you, there's a cool factor to it that just makes you feel cool.
Yep.
And then you also then you start to reflect on it and feel like it's the most impractical way to shoot a gun, but.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So
I think, I mean, Nathan, HK I always had like just... that. What?
Go ahead.
I was saying HK had like the 3-round burst. They may still do it. I don't even know, but they did a study on it that it like that third round was the most useless, dangerous round ever like launched out of a gun. It never hit the target.
You know, the first time I went out with an MP5, it was actually with a SWAT team. They were teaching me. So it was like the best day of my life. Right. I got to go out and play with MP5s. They were full auto and suppressed.
Yeah.
So it was like so much fun that day. That was also the same day that I got to shoot a Tommy gun, a full auto Tommy gun. And it's you, when you get in there, I totally understand. I mean, especially when you start shooting a Tommy gun, Tommy guns climb really fast.
Mm-hmm.
You think of just that recoil, that third round and that 3-round burst, your muzzle's already risen a couple of inches, unless you're really pushing down on it. Unless you really know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right. And you're conscious of it. But yeah, I could see where that third round would be like the most useless round.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Especially on those. I mean, those things have a lot of climb to them.
Yeah.
That's well, that's like most companies nowadays throw comps on there when like it steals your energy, but it also like for like the climbing and whatnot. I personally hate comps with all my heart and soul. I think compensators are compensating for poor rifle construction. That's why that's why we designed our system to smoothly operate and have no muzzle rise. But yeah, no, it's the full auto climb is crazy. It's
fun when you see like range day and the full auto booths usually have a guy standing there with a hand on the back of the shooter.
Oh yeah. Right? And just ready to just like rack that thing down.
Yeah. Cause
Hey, it you want to learn how like proper like form and shooting though? Like that's full auto is a great way to learn how to properly control a rifle because you're doing it fast.
Yeah. You are making corrections in fractions of seconds.
Yeah, and you're seeing where the weakness is, and you're seeing like it, like if you're shooting semi-auto, you're kind of seeing your weakness, like you can kind of feel it, but running full auto, you see if you're controlling it or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So,
well, Nathan, man, thank you for taking out time to talk to us today. I really appreciate it. This was a great conversation talking about building ARs rather than assembling ARs. And when you do it right, this is the results that you can get from it. I really appreciate you taking that time out.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. This has been a fun conversation.
Yeah, for me as well.
Yeah, this has been good. Podcasts are fun. I enjoy podcasts a whole lot more than I enjoy like interviews, like the second, because like you get long form. Like I and this is what I appreciate. Like you come having me on, it's like I get to actually explain the thought process and like it's how do you put that in an elevator pitch? Like
you can't.
No,
you can't. And that's the funny thing is you talk about, you know, there's also a lost art of conversation that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I love about having a podcast. Last week I did a podcast swap with Mia Anstein, and I was on her podcast in the morning and she was on mine in the afternoon. And, it was so great because it, you know, like what I told you in the beginning of this, and the audience is like, why are these guys still going on? you know, I really worked this podcast on one question and the audience never hears the question because I cut it off. So for the audience, I asked Nathan in the beginning, would you mind introducing yourself to the audience? That is the one question I ask on this podcast. Everything else is where we go is where we go. For the audience, that gets cut off when you hear the person talking about, hi, I'm so-and-so. That's the question they got asked and you never hear it. So it's great having conversations with people and being able to discuss things like a system. And understanding how a system works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so, especially with ARs, most people don't like actually like think of them as a system or understand that. So it's like it once you explain it and you hear it, like a light bulb comes on. It's like, oh my God, these are different. Like it's like I need 45 minutes of your time.
Exactly. So well, Nathan, man, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Now, thinking of AR as a collection of parts is what most people think of, especially builders, right? You know, the home builders, the DIYers. Getting out of that and thinking of it as a system goes back to, well, like the origins of the rifle. I mean, there was a reason why Eugene Stoner designed this rifle. It wasn't because, hey, let's take this barrel, let's take this and put this together. It's going back to rethinking this system. And that's what I like about companies like Mitchell Defense. Going into thermal fitting of barrels. They're not the only ones, but very few manufacturers are doing this. And he went, hey, look, this is my experience in the past. Let's move this thing forward and put this into a rifle. It's not like everyone's like, you need the form fit. It's not like he's going out the forums. He's looking at this with fresh set of eyes, which is why I wanted him on the podcast when I talked to him at SHOT. Definitely go check out Mitchell Defense. The link for them down below. Now, I have a redesigned website. I've been working on this thing for a little over a month. I'm putting content back up. I mean, I literally hit delete on the webpage because I hated it so much. There's articles that I lost, but that's okay because I'm rewriting them. They're old anyway. I mean, there was an article out there talking about how to build an 80% 1911 for under $400. It's impossible to do. It has been impossible to do for, God, at least 3 years. So I'm going back and redoing articles, redid the websites, really great. Go check it out at www.trb.fyi. And while you're there, in the menu, there's this thing called Partners and Discounts. Go there before you do your online shopping. Click on that Partners link, go shopping. and a small portion of your purchase is going to come back to the channel so I can continue to bring you content. Look, I really need your help here. It costs a lot of money to do some of these projects that I have coming up that you're going to want to see. So it's going to cost you absolutely nothing to support the channel doing it that way. I mean, I have partners like Brownells, Amazon. Like, if you go right to the webpage, there's an Amazon logo there. You click on that, it takes you right to Amazon, and you support the channel. It's not going to cost you one penny more than you are going to already spend. Help out immensely with doing this. Look, I'm getting shadow banned really, really hard. I mean, I am watching my watch time hours just dropping. Views on videos are dropping like crazy. I just need your help to get this thing out. Share it, right? That's absolutely free. Tell people about the work that's happening over here at the Rogue Banshee. Now, if you're watching on YouTube, click that video right there. That video is an interview I did with Mia Anstein. It's the last podcast episode. Super amazing person. You're going to want to watch that or listen to it if you're on the audio side. Thanks for listening. Hope you're staying safe out there. I look forward to talking to you again soon.